This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and introduce Dr. Aaron Kohler, who is an Associate Professor of Near Eastern and Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University, and is here this year on sabbatical, and we're really delighted to have him here. His most recent book is Esther and Ancient Jewish Thoughts, which made it a no-brainer for us to invite him here at this time of year. And we certainly like taking advantage of biblical scholars. We hope that by your next sabbatical, you'll have written on a different topic so we can, you know, you'll have to tell us what's next. Anyway, Dr. Aaron Kohler, thank you.
Thank you, Alex. It's good to see everyone. Those who I know and those who I hopefully we'll have a chance to meet. The Megillat Esther, of course, is a very familiar book. So familiar that that sometimes hampers our ability to approach it with fresh eyes and to read it as a book and to think about it as maybe we couldn't have as children. Maybe we have been doing this for a number of years already. I had a teacher who once talked about some of the stories in Tanakh suffering from the problem of the omniscient reader. The omniscient narrator, of course, is well known, but the omniscient reader is the one who goes into a story and already knows everything about the story, which is often how we approach stories in Tanakh, because we do know them. We know them from the time we were 6 years old. We know how they end. And so it's hard to feel the suspense. It's hard to appreciate some of the developments, hard to really experience the plot twists, the ups and downs, and so on. Esther is a masterpiece of literature. It's very short. You can get it down to 2 or 3 pages if you shrink the font enough. But 10 Prakim, if you were writing a book review, I think clearly the only criticism might be that the end drags a bit, which I think is actually true, and there's something to talk about as to why that happens. I don't think we're under any obligation to think that the author's literary choices were necessarily the best possible literary choices. One could say that the end was not done as well as the beginning. But the first 7 or 8 Prakim are just masterpieces of literature. Incredibly concise. The plot is told with just broad brushstrokes. We hear the characters. We get a lot about the personality of the main characters in just a word or two. We'll talk a little bit about the characters at the last part of this evening and hopefully develop it a little bit more next week. But the author really did a tremendous job in telling a story concisely and yet richly. And what I'll try to do this evening and next week is to say that actually we understand even more what the author did if we situate the book in history. Of course, the author couldn't possibly have known that 2,500 years later people would still be reading the book. During his time, there were Jews living in Yerushalayim, so it might not have shocked him that people in Yerushalayim would read the book. But the rest of the world, of course, you know, Jews all around the world reading the Book of Esther is something that he couldn't possibly have imagined. And one has to ask who he was writing for and what he wanted to do with his book for those people. So just... Yeah, I would say something about it. In general, ancient literature, it's, you know, a slam dunk that we're talking about male authors. Esther is at least somewhat more hesitation before saying that with certainty, but the chances are just so overwhelmingly good that it was a male author based on who's reading, who's writing, that you could take it with an asterisk every time I say it, but although I would love, on political grounds, to be able to talk about female authors, I think, historically speaking, it's almost certainly a man. But it's a good point, and that should come with an asterisk, if only for lack of certainty. So, just in very broad strokes, we're talking about a person who's living presumably in Galut. This is also something that's impossible to prove, but almost certainly the author is living in Galut, in Persia or Bavel. He seems to know something about the geography of Shushan. He understands where the palace is, understands that Shushan HaBira is different from Ma'ir Shushan. Maybe even understands that you cross a river to get from one to the other. There's a number of hints that he understands well the culture and the reality of life in the Persian court. That's not an ironclad argument. Someone could have visited, someone could have heard, but the chances are very good that he's living out in Galut, in Paras or Bavel. When is he living? That's actually a harder question. The most solid dates that we have, of course, are the dates of King Ahasuerus. King Ahasuerus is a real person. His name in Persian was Khshayarsha. The Greeks, they don't have a sh in their alphabet, so they wrote it as Kherkhes. The letter that's pronounced Kha in Greek is X, which Americans pronounce however they feel like it. So they pronounce it Xerxes. It's a little bit disappointing that in modern Hebrew his name is Xerxes. Instead of bringing it something closer to the older Persian or Semitic, Ahasuerus is not a bad transliteration of Khshayarsha. But through the Greek, through the Latin, and then to the English, Xerxes, of course, doesn't sound anything like Khshayarsha. But Ahasuerus and Khshayarsha are clearly the same person. So we know his dates. He rules from 485 to 465 BCE. So the specific years aren't that important, but let's just situate that in Jewish history. 485, he comes to the throne. He rules for 20 years. How long have the Jews been in Galut when Ahasuerus comes to the throne in 485? Or when did the Jews go to Galut? Yeah, so Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in 587, 586. But Mordechai's family has actually been there even longer, right? Who did he go to Galut with? Yechoniah, right. Yoyachin, that first Galut, which was about 11 years earlier. So about 597, Yechoniah, Yoyachin was exiled by the Babylonians. And we're told that Mordechai's family, his great-grandfather, went to exile with Yoyachin, with Yechoniah. That's great. Four generations, 120 years or so. That makes very good sense. The chronology seems to work out very nicely. It's wonderful. But let's think about what that means. It means that Mordechai has never seen Yerushalayim in his life, right? You can't talk about Shivat Zion in a concrete way for people of Mordechai's generation. They were born in Galut. Their parents were born in Galut. Their grandparents might have been born in Galut. They've never been in Yehuda. Some people did go back. When Koresh and the Persians took over the Babylonian Empire, he let the Jews go back. And we're told that some Jews went back. A very small number, relatively speaking, a few thousand, went back to Yerushalayim. And within 20 years or so, they built a Beit HaMikdash. And when Mordechai was born, there was a Beit HaMikdash functioning in Yerushalayim with a very poor, very small community, a city that's not walled. We know from Nehemiah that he needs to build the walls. It's an impoverished community. It's a weak community. It's politically totally voiceless. And it's essentially a small community out in the western corner of the Persian Empire. Because remember, Yerushalayim is also part of the Persian Empire. So it's not like the Jews had a choice to live in their own country with political autonomy or to live in the Persian Empire. Wherever they went, they were living in the Persian Empire. Mehodu v'ad Kush, they were in the Persian Empire. But some chose to be in Yerushalayim. The vast majority chose to stay in the center of the empire, in the regions of Bavel and Paras. How exactly Mordechai's family got to Shushan, we never hear. Koresh, the Persians takes over the Babylonian Empire in 539. But how exactly Mordechai's family gets to Shushan from Bavel, we never exactly find out, right? There's Galut Bavel, the Jews come to Bavel, Iraq. At some point between Galut Bavel and now, when Mordechai being in Ahasuerus' kingdom, he or his parents have moved even farther eastward to the center of the new empire. Not to Bavel, but now to the capital, one of the capitals of the Persian Empire. Now, what do we know about the Persian Empire? The Persian Empire lasts for more than two centuries. 539, they take over, and they end only when Alexander comes to the region and wars against the Persians in a series of wars and eventually takes over the whole region. In the 330s, late 330s, depending on where exactly you are in the region, 333, 332, 331. But more than two centuries that the Persians rule the entire Near East. It's a very long time. And what the Persians are best known for is the stability of their empire, except on the borders. So we know that they're fighting against the Greeks, right? This is famous because Ahasuerus is contemporary with Herodotus, for example. And his successor is contemporary with Thucydides. So we know a lot about this time from the Greek perspective. But Greece is very, very far away. Hundreds of miles to the west. No one in Shushan is affected by what's going on, except very indirectly, on the western frontier. On the eastern frontier, in what's now Afghanistan and Pakistan, they're also warring. But in between Afghanistan and essentially Egypt, the Mediterranean Sea, the Persian Empire is incredibly stable. If you live there, you're benefiting from the stability of a massively impressive and important and developed empire. For people from New York, at least, probably the most living remnant of that is the inscription on the post office that I understand they're going to be replacing at some point. But the big post office across the Madison Square Garden is engraved with this long inscription that says, "Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night shall stay these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds," which is a line from Herodotus about the Persian postal system. That's the postal system was world famous because they were incredibly efficient, which of course we could have gotten that impression from Esther also, right? You're sitting in Shushan, you're writing a letter, and you send it out in every language, in every script to Mehodu v'ad Kush. This is an incredibly efficient empire, which if you're living there, presumably is very convenient, meaning you enjoy it. You enjoy the benefits of the stability. No one's fighting you. No one's attacking you. If you're in Shushan, you're incredibly safe. There's wars a few hundred miles to your east, a few hundred miles to your west. But where you are, things are good. Things are stable. This is a wonderful empire to live in. But pragmatically, that's true. Theologically, that is actually a horrific problem to live with for the Jews. Because let's think about what the Jews have always grown up believing and thinking and reading about in the earlier books of Tanakh. The Jews have told long stories, right? And all of Tanakh basically revolves around some major themes. The major themes are, we have a land, it was promised a very, very long time ago, we weren't there, we are there, eventually come back. There's going to be a Beit HaMikdash, right? Not a theme introduced early, but quickly, there's going to be a Beit HaMikdash. Another theme that comes in, but becomes very central, is there's going to be a king, there's going to be political autonomy, right? We have our own government. When other people take over, that's because God's angry at us. We are politically autonomous. That's a central theme in how Tanakh thinks about Jewish destiny, Jewish history. And of course, most important, controlling all of this, is Hashem, right? We have, God is controlling our political faiths, our religious faiths, everything is involved in our relationship with God, and then as a result of that, he'll figure out the rest. And now, Mordechai's generation is born in exile, in this empire that doesn't seem to be going anywhere, and really wouldn't have gone anywhere, amazingly effective at just living day to day, smoothly, without a lot of problems. No one seems to be attacking this empire. Of course, the Babylonians, who conquered Yerushalayim, who destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, you had Nevi'im who said, look, this is going to happen. You're not being good. Variations on that theme. You're not being good. Hashem is angry with you. He's going to bring in the Babylonians. He's going to punish you. And then, 70 years, and it will come to an end. Now, that came and went. What's with these Persians? They just sort of swooped in, took over, and nothing seems to be going away. No one promised an end to this. There is no end in sight. What do you do here? What happened to political autonomy? There is a Beit HaMikdash, but it's so poor. I mean, Sefer Ezra tells us that the elders who remembered Shlomo's Beit HaMikdash, who then saw Beit Sheni being built, cried at the sight because it was so impoverished. It was so inferior to what they had been used to. So there's a Beit HaMikdash, but that's not what we were talking about when we talked about the Beit HaMikdash. The land is not ours. Even if there are Jews who live there, it's part of the Persian Empire. So there's no autonomy even if you go there. So what happened to life here? What's happening here? And a lot of the literature that's produced by Jews around this time, including Sfarim like Daniel and Esther, a couple of other books in Tanakh, and other books that we don't have in Tanakh, but we now know of from the Dead Sea Scrolls or from elsewhere, revolve around these questions. Well, how do we make sense of life now that things seem to be so different from what we were promised, what we expected, what we had always grown up to think was obvious to be the life of the Jews. So, time and place, because it gives us a sense of what's plausible and what's not plausible for what the author could have been intending. I won't belabor that point, but I think that's important to think. When you hear, the author, this is what the book's about, you say, like, well, is that really plausible? That in around 400, 450 BCE, sitting in the Eastern diaspora, could an author really have been saying that? So I'd like to sort of put that in the front of our minds, that we need to be thinking about what the author in a real time, in a real place, might have actually been thinking and trying to do with the book. Last introductory point is that Esther got responses and reactions from readers relatively quickly. Now, by relatively quickly, I mean by our standards of ancient history. So within just like 300 years, we have reactions. If any author today had to wait 300 years to get reactions to their work, they might not be all that thrilled with that. It takes long enough, you put something out there and it takes like months till someone says anything about it. But by our standards of ancient history, within a few centuries, we already have reactions. And very important to say, the reactions are almost uniformly what I'll call negative. By which I mean, other later writers either correct the Book of Esther, fix it up, ignore it, or argue with it. And the fixing up, corrections, are what I think are the most interesting. We'll see a little bit of that this evening and more of that next week. Because, of course, if a later author quotes an earlier story but corrects it, means adds something, fixes up something, then you see what they thought was problematic about the earlier story. Right? They only correct something if they think there's a problem. So because of that, because the early reactions can show us how people were reading it, throughout this evening and next week, I'm going to be going back and forth between the Megillah itself and later reactions to the Megillah, but all from the ancient world. Okay, so the plan for tonight is to spend a little bit of time on three topics. Three topics are the connection to Shaul, connection to Yitziat Mitzrayim, and hopefully we'll have time to start the issue of the characters of Mordechai and Esther, reading them politically. So those are the three topics that hopefully we'll spend a bit of time on this evening. Okay, so starting with Shaul. I think it's well known that Megillat Esther alludes to, recalls, some of the details of the story of Shaul HaMelech from Sefer Shmuel Aleph. In particular, the most important connection is to one story, which we'll come back to, the story in Perek Tet Vav of Shaul's war against Amalek. But more broadly, it recalls a lot of aspects of Shaul as king, his rise to kingship, and so on. I don't want to belabor this literary point, because the point I want to make is that literary analyses, for our purposes anyway, are most important because they give us a clue as to what the author wants us to do politically with those allusions. So I want us to see that the author of Esther wants us to think about the story of Shaul, but the real question I want us to think about is, why? Why would he be asking us to think about Shaul? It's cute that he's reminding us of Shmuel Aleph. That's lovely. It's always fun to see how Tanakh refers to itself. And in another context, that's a good shiur in and of itself. But for our purposes, actually much more important to say, fine, he did that. Why? What's he after? Why is he thinking about Shaul? Shaul is a neglected and disregarded figure in Jewish history for apparently good reason. He was kicked out of the kingship by Shmuel at the order of God. So why would anyone go back and sort of drag Shaul out of history and say, this is our model here? So first of all, let me just look at a couple of the points that make it really, I think, very clear that the author of Esther is not only thinking about Shaul, but wants you to think about Shaul as soon as you start meeting his main characters. As soon as you meet Mordechai and Esther, he wants you to be thinking about Shaul. So first of all, the way he introduces the characters is actually very reminiscent of the way Shaul is introduced. Whereas the introduction of Mordechai and Esther is well known. We don't get it until a little bit into the second perek of the Megillah. And there we find, Ish Yehudi Aya B'Shoshana Bira, Ushmo Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shimi Ben Kish Ish Yimini. Then we get a sort of parenthesis, Asher Aglam Yerushalayim, Megola Asher Aglatayim, Yechanyan Melech Yudah, Asher Aglam Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel. And then back to the introduction, Vayi Omenet HaDasahi Esther. So, leaving out the parenthesis for now, What are we told? There was a Jewish man in the fortress of Shushan, and his name was Mordechai, the son of Yair, son of Shimi, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, Ishimini, who was exiled. The who? Who's the who? Who was exiled? His great-grandfather, exactly, the last person mentioned. Kish, right, not Mordechai. Mordechai would then be 150 or so. Kish was exiled. He was exiled by Yomin, and he was training Hadassah, who is Esther. Those two names we'll come back to, because that's so rich. So we suddenly find out she has two names, one of which is very quickly dropped from the story, that the author is clearly doing something with the names. That we'll come back to. Back in Shmuel Aleph, we read, Vayhi ish mi Binyamin, ushmo Kish, ben Aviel, ben Sror, ben Bechorat, ben Afiach, ben Ishimini, gibor chayo, v'lo ayaven, ushmo Shaul, bachur vatov. So there is a man from Benjamin, and his name is Kish, son of Aviel, son of Tzor, son of Bechorat, son of Afiach, son of a Benjaminite man, a military hero, and he had a son, and his name was Shaul. Now, both in terms of the structure of the introductions, and in terms of the specific names, Kish and Ishimini, clearly you read those Psukim and Perek Bet of Esther, and you say, this sounds very, very familiar, I know who it is. Note also that in both cases, the character that actually needs to be introduced is not introduced until the second part, right? Mordechai might or might not be the main character of the Megillah. That's debatable. But in context of Perek Bet, the character we need is certainly not Mordechai. Right? The context is Ahasuerus is looking for a new wife. He has this bizarre contest going on. We need to know about Esther. We hear first about Mordechai and then it's, oh, and by the way, he omein et hadasahi Esther, she is the important one. In Shmuel, we hear about this guy named Kish, who it turns out we couldn't care less about. Right? In this case, it's not debatable. We don't care about Kish at all, except that he lost donkeys. Shaul is the important person, and he only comes in the second verse. So the structure of the introductions is very, very similar. And again, with the names Kish and the name and the word Ishimini in there, the allusion really couldn't be missed by anyone who was familiar with the story of Shaul. Now, both Shaul and Esther, I'm just going to run through these very quickly, don't reveal something very important. Esther, of course, very famously doesn't reveal her nationality. Shmuel, after is anointed king, v'tvaram lucha lo higid lo, he neglects to tell people that he's the king of Israel. Agag and Amalek, this is really central, so I'll just mention it now. But Mordechai and Esther, of course, succeed by defeating Haman Ha'agagi, who's never explicitly called an Amaleki, but Agag is not a nation that we hear of anywhere else in Tanakh. So it seems like we have no choice but to interpret Agagi as having something to do with the only other Agag we've ever heard of, who is the Agag king of Amalek, whom Shaul defeated in battle, but didn't murder. Right, exactly. And although, you know, that word makes it even harder to get behind the story. Yeah, exactly. Execute would have been cleaner. But neutralized, to use the term of the day, right? It's sad that we can laugh at that. Okay, anyway. Right, so the Agagi clearly refers back to Agag, king of Amalek, and again, that we'll come back to in a moment. Again, just running through these things, but one of Shaul's early mistakes was that when there were challenges to his authority, Vayihi kimacharish, he stayed silent. Mordechai tells Esther, what must you not do? Kimacharish tacharishi, vayitazor, right? You must not stay silent at this time. Both of them refer to their Beit Av. Both of them, interestingly, in both stories of Shaul and of Esther, they both host two successive banquets. Esther, I assume, is more familiar. So she, of course, hosts banquets on two successive days, at which the second one, of course, is a very dramatic revelation, where she charges Haman and so on. In Perakaf, in Shmuel Aleph, Shaul also hosts two feasts. The first one passes uneventfully. The second one, Shaul gets very angry at Yonatan for betraying him and protecting David. Yonatan then says, kaltahara'a me'imo. Right? Shaul has decided with finality, definitely, intends evil against David, which is the same exact phrase that Haman uses, that he sees, ki kaltah ilav hara'a me'et hamelech. So the stories are really remarkably remarkably parallel. Revach, interesting expression, Revach eludes Shaul. And how does he get Revach? How does he get peace? He needs music, right? And that's one of the ways that David enters his court. Is to bring him Revach the Shaul. He actually brings Revach the Shaul. Of course, Esther succeeds in bringing, well, what she has to do is bring Revach Vatzalah, which she eventually does. And again, finally, and this brings us back to the crucial story, in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tetzvav, Shaul and Bnei Israel, in direct violation of what Shmuel told them to do, did bring back plunder from their war against Amalek, right? Remember how Shmuel knows that? Yeah, he hears the tone, right? He hears the tone. He hears the tone. He uses the word meh there instead of ma, which some people have actually read as him sort of mocking, like, meh, hakol atzon hazeh. Of course, Esther, in a nice reversal of that, a correction of what Shaul did, they do kill their enemies, and v'abiza lo shalchot yadam, right? They don't touch the plunder, even though they were allowed to explicitly, according to the decree that Mordechai and Esther sent out. So, in a very nice reversal, Shaul was told, don't touch the plunder, and his people did. He says it wasn't him, but his people did. Mordechai and Esther tell the people, you can take the plunder, and they don't do it. Thus, mitakein, right? They correct what Shaul did wrong. So there's the crucial story, and I'll spend another moment on this in a second. But the crucial story is clearly the story about Amalek. That's clearly where the two narratives intersect the most, where Shaul fought against Amalek, did not kill Agag as he was supposed to, and his people did take the plunder, the spoils, and Esther and Mordechai and the Jews under their realm fight against Amalek, do kill all of the enemies of the Jews, right, and even ask for an extra day to do so, which again, a little bit ethically off-putting at the end, but they succeed in wiping out all of the enemies of the Jews, correcting the mistake that Shaul made, and further correction, they don't take the spoil, even though they're explicitly allowed to take the plunder. So that's all great. Now, it's really fascinating to think about the claim that Esther and Mordechai are correcting what Shaul didn't do. Now, yeah, Shaul did a lot of things that weren't so great, but on the whole, at this point in Jewish history, in the days of Bayit Sheni, it really doesn't matter to anyone. Shaul's family is not vying for the melucha against anyone else. There doesn't seem to be a live political party, the pro-Shaul party, who needs to sort of go back in history and say, you know, our ancestor, he did some bad things, but like we're going to fix that and we apologize for his mistakes. Who cares? Shaul was a very long time ago, right? We're talking about almost 600 years ago, 550 years earlier, a long time ago, from Shevet Binyamin, which is not in charge of anyone. And it seems sort of a waste of time to spend a whole story correcting the mistakes that Shaul made. It's very nice, but Shaul was superseded by someone much more important, right? David, Beit David ruled for 400 years, and even in Bayit Sheni, Beit David is a living entity. Shesh Batzar apparently comes from Beit David, leading the return to Yerushalayim under Koresh. Beit David is serious. Why is anyone bothering to write a story about Shaul? It seems like a blast from the past. I haven't heard about this guy in a few centuries. And here comes an author to correct everything about Shaul. So there seems to be at least two things going on. Some people have read this really strongly, that the author's actually pro-Shaul. I'm not sure exactly what that would mean. But I read it a little bit more weakly. What the author is doing is not so much, he doesn't really care about Shaul. Shaul really is dead and buried, and his dynasty is long gone. What the author cares about, though, is setting up an alternative to Beit David. Because Beit David comes with all sorts of overtones, right? What does it mean? If you're talking about Beit David, what are you talking about? What does Beit David stand for if you're sitting in Persia in the 5th century? Mashiach. Yeah, what do you mean by Mashiach? Since I don't know exactly what they would have meant.
Someone to redeem them, to bring them back.
Bring them back? Something we'll come back to in a minute. What did you... Someone...
restoration of the Malchut.
Yeah, exactly. We want to reclaim political autonomy, right? When we talk about Malchut, it's not enough to have a figurehead there that the Persians have sort of handed over control, but real Malchut, right? Real kingship, which doesn't answer to other human kings. Certainly creating a political center, an autonomous political center in Yerushalayim, unifying all of Bnei Israel, right? Where are most of Bnei Israel at this point? Yeah, they're scattered all around the empire. What's David known for taking the 12 Shvatim, bringing them together, unifying them, creating a center in Yerushalayim from which the Jewish people can be ruled. That's a notion that other people in the days of Bayit Sheni were trumpeting. We're saying this is what we're looking for, this is what we're hoping for. Maybe even we've seen the beginning of it with Sheish Batzar, and we just need to get the rest of it, right? We're agitating for political autonomy, we're agitating for a return to Beit David. And what does the author of Esther say? Well, there's a whole other model of Melucha. What's this model of Melucha? Well, first of all, it's a different person. He almost wipes out Beit David from history, right? Who are the Jewish leaders now? We have Shaul a very long time ago, and his descendants, namely Mordechai and Esther. Okay, so we have Jewish leaders. But it's much more subversive than just that, than just setting up an alternative to David. Because if Mordechai and Esther fix what Shaul failed to do, where do they do it? In Galut. So Shaul was unable or unwilling to do what he was supposed to do to Amalek in Eretz Israel with an independent Melucha. Now, it's not just a sort of hypothesis that there should be some connection between Amalek and being in Eretz Israel. In Dvarim, in Perek Kafai, we read, Vayah Baniach Hashem Elokecha Lecha, is in the middle of the second page. Vayah Baniach Hashem Elokecha Lecha Mikol Oyvecha Misaviv Ba'aret Asher Hashem Elokecha Noten Lecha Nachala Lerishta Tzimchet Zeichar Amalek Mitachat Hashemayim Lo Tishkach. So when is the command to wipe out Amalek? When you are in your land and having conquered all your enemies, right? Vayah Hashem Elokecha Mikol Oyvecha. When you've establish yourself in your land, then Timchet Zechar Malek. Now, they almost did it, right? They did. They had Yoshua, the Shoftim, Kibush, Nachala. They were established in the land. They had the Menucha, right? Baniach, they had the Menucha. And now Shmuel says, great, Shaul, now it's your job. Do the next thing. What's the next thing? Go Timchet Zechar Malek. And he fails to do it. And the author of Esther says, but we did it. But of course, we did it in a very subversive way. Where did we do it? We did it by traveling 700 miles out to the east and finding this one Agagi out in the royal court in Shushan, and we got him. And so as a result of that, what happens to us? And this is the most subversive thing about the whole Megillah. What happens to us as a result of tracking down the Agagim and killing them, and we beat our enemies, and so what? So we get to not be massacred, right? The power is real power. It's real power, but it's power through the Persian imperial bureaucracy, right? There's no happy ending in the Megillah that says, now that we've beaten Amalek once and for all, we get to, what would be an expected ending? We get to go back to Eretz Israel, right? We had to come here to track down the enemies, but now we can go back. One of the most amazing things about the Megillah is that it's totally fixated on the here and now. There's virtually no past. The one line about Mordechai's great-grandfather being exiled is the only reference to anything before current events, and there is literally no future. But the Megillah ends with the most mundane thing that you could possibly imagine.
Taxes.
That's not meant to be trivial. I mean, it's meant to be trivial in a deep way. Meaning, what's Geula, says the author? We've now beaten Amalek, so what do we get? We get to live another day. That's not a small thing, right? But it's also not a grand thing. There's no dream here of, and now we get to reinstate Beit David. No, Beit David wiped out of history. What do we have here? We have Beit Shaul. What's Beit Shaul? Beit Shaul is interested in living here and now. We made it through this generation. We'll talk about this a little bit more in a bit, but what about next generation? I don't know. There's nothing preventing this from happening again next generation. Yeah.
Mordechai will govern shalom lechol zaro. Mm-hmm. Seems to imply generations coming after Mordechai.
So, that is about the most hint that we have that there is a future generation, right? It's amazing that Esther doesn't have kids, for example, right? Now, it would have been problematic because her kids would have been Persian princes or something, which is something we'll hopefully talk a little bit more about. But it's really amazing how fixated consciously the author stays on the events of today. 100%. I'm not saying that the author doesn't anticipate a future. Doesn't anticipate a future. And he knows that there's a past. But unlike, for example, Sefer Daniel, which starts with a long story about once upon a time we had a Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, and then came the Babylonians and destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, they brought us here, and that's how we got people in Bavel, and now there are three people that we need to know about, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, and their friend Daniel, and that's why they're in Bavel. We don't get anything like that here. Okay, here we get, oh, it's the third year of Achashverosh. It's as if this is where we were born, and it's as if this is where we'll die. But agreed, there is, of course, a future generation. It's just not the purpose of the Megillah to talk about it. And again, hopefully we'll come back to that, because I think it's actually an incredibly important point about the Megillah and what the vision of Geulah is for the Megillah. It's literally, we didn't die this generation, and we get to get to the next generation. And again, I don't mean to minimize that. That's actually a big deal. But, it's not as grand as one could imagine.
Debate between Zionists and Territorialists.
Okay.
19th century.
Yeah, so I'm not even sure that Esther is even in the Zionist camp.
No, she's a Territorialist.
Oh, okay.
In other words, the Jewish future outside right. of Eretz Israel was supposed to be the goal being to go back.
Right. So I wouldn't put it that extreme. To a large extent, I think you're right. I think it's, let's put it this way, it's not an ideology of the Megillah, I think, that we oughtn't go back. It's a pragmatic reality that this is where we live right now. And if we go back, great. If someone comes and takes us back, this is not someone who's saying, no, the Jews are a diaspora people. I reject all efforts to reconstruct a political autonomous homeland. I don't think this is an anti-Zionist. It's someone who says, I'm not opposed to it. I know life here. And I know, I want to come back to this hopefully later, but let me say something that I think the author would have said very, very realistic. There are Jews in Yerushalayim. You know what would have happened to them if there hadn't been Jews in Shushan? They all would have been killed by Haman's decree. The only reason they're saved is because we have Jews in Shushan who can undercut it.
I stay in America to protect Israel's interests. But another way...
Do you hear my accent, by the
way? Another way if we look at it from the author's perspective, since he is describing this is the way the Jews of Persia reacted and felt and what they did, we could also be looking at this as a parody and saying, look at these Jews having a great time at Ahasuerus' party, look at them being happy about being able to live another day, how pathetic.
Yeah, so I'd say two things about it. One is that Perek Aleph, I think, is satirical. Not of the Jews, but of the Persians. It really does mock the culture of the court. That I think is true, and the Greeks did that a lot also. The Greeks had never seen anything as bombastic and opulent as the Persian court and how many banquets they have, and it's a trope in Greek literature of the time to also mock these inordinately long banquets that the Persians carry on with. So I think there's a lot of satire in Perek Aleph in particular. But I don't see even a hint in the Megillah that he's critical of his heroes. Mordechai and Esther, I think every reader, and this is actually one of my problems in speaking about Esther, exactly your point, because if I had to choose, I'd be on the other side. But I think it's important to give Esther the book, its voice. But I think every reader of Esther, until modern Zionists, read the book and realized that Mordechai and Esther are good, positive heroes, not people that the author is making fun of. Right? Now, it's entirely understandable why someone would not want to read it that way, and I think if he put his finger on it, and you're putting your finger on it also, it flies in the face of much of what we believe and what the rest of Tanakh believes. Right? So I think that's important. It's a good reason to say, hey, maybe that's not... is it really possible that that's what Esther's saying? But there isn't even a hint in the book of making fun of Mordechai and Esther and the Jews in Shushan. And that's, I think, important to say. So that's what I meant, actually, when I said at the beginning, you have to think about what's plausible an author living in Galut in the 400s is much more likely to just be pragmatic about it than to be cynical about it. He says, look, this is life here. Do I think it's ideal? So I'll come to that in a second. I don't think he thinks it's the ideal. He would rather go back to a Jewish homeland with Beit HaMikdash and Nevi'im and so on. If you ask him, but he says, okay, but that's not realistic right now. There's nothing I can do about that. What I can do right now is work in the power structures that I know to do the best that I can for the Jews throughout the Persian Empire, including the ones who are giving up their well-being and building the Beit HaMikdash and living in Yerushalayim. So I just don't see any satire. I don't see any hint here, and I think the author is pretty clear that Mordechai and Esther are positive characters. But I also think it's understandable why the reading, which sort of has gotten traction
recently. Well, I mean, the positive characters, if you accept that a Jewish woman, it's good for a Jewish woman to live with a
great point. Great point. Yeah, but think about.
I mean, if there's no religious character to anything they do other than saving their lives.
Exactly. From that's very well said.
Perspective, it's a satire on these people who are totally materialistic and after their own soul.
Well, but can I ask you a question? Do you think Jews for the last 2,000 years actually read it as a satire? I think everyone understood that Mordechai and Esther are heroes, not people who unfortunately didn't understand what life was really all about.
I think that people might not have understood the message because we weren't allowed to dream of the impossible. Hmm.
Okay, so I would, just as an alternative, submit that maybe people today, because of, what again, political visions that I share, don't want to accept a diaspora-centric book in Tanakh. All right, so you know what? Let's actually move on to the Yetziat Mitzrayim story, because I think it picks up on exactly what we were, the ideas that we've just been talking about. And maybe makes a point even a bit more subversively strong. Okay, so let's just say it this way. Just again, I'm not going to read much of this out loud because it would sort of belabor a point that we don't need to go in a lot of detail for our purposes. So let's just suffice with saying that in Galut Bavel and the early days of Bayit Sheni, many Jews, and we can just judge this only from Tanakh, but many Jews seem to have expected a repeat of Yetziat Mitzrayim. Maybe grander than Yetziat Mitzrayim, maybe different from Yetziat Mitzrayim, all sorts of variations on the theme, but essentially the thinking is, look, we were in Galut before, right? And we were saved from Galut by Hashem, who swooped in, B'yad Chazakah v'Zeron Netuyah, took us out of Galut and brought us to Eretz Yisrael, and now we're in Galut again. Presumably the same thing will happen. So just to point a couple of interesting passages. Navi Yechezkel, who lived all the way back in the early days of Galut Bavel. So this is sort of a vicious twist on the Yetziat Mitzrayim, but in the passage you have at the top of the third page, starting from Pasuk Lamed Gimel, says, Chai ani neum Hashem Elokim, im lo biyad chazaka v'zro netuya v'chema shvucha, im lo chalechem. V'otzeiti etchem min ha'amim, v'kibatzti etchem min ha'aratot asher nefotzatem bam. Biyad chazaka v'zro netuya v'chema shvucha. V'heveiti etchem el midbar ha'amim, v'nishpatzi etchem sham panim el panim. Right, so the language is straight out of Yetziat Mitzrayim. V'otzeiti v'kibatzti v'heveiti v'kibatzti, I know it's not actually in Shmot. Biyad chazaka v'zro netuya, I'm going to take you out with a strong hand and outstretched arm. I'm going to bring you out of the land. I'm going to bring you into the midbar. And then, in case any of his obtuse listeners didn't get the point, in Pasuk Lamed Vav he says, "Kasher nishpatati et avotechem b'midbar eretz Mitzrayim, kein yishafet itchem neum Hashem Elokim." Just as I did outside of Mitzrayim, so I will do with you as well. So very clearly thinking about a new Yetziat Mitzrayim now. In Yechezkel, it's a negative because God's going to take the opportunity to bring the people out of Bavel, punish the people who didn't believe in him, and then bring only the deserving ones all the way to Eretz Yisrael. But very strongly drawing on the notion of Yetziat Mitzrayim as a model for what's going to happen. How is this Galut Bavel going to end? Another Yetziat Mitzrayim, or it's called Yetziat Bavel. In a more positive realm, the Navi in Yeshayahu Nun Aleph says, it calls on God to get up and do something again like you did back in the days of Yetziat Mitzrayim. Uri, Uri, Livshi Oz, Zeroa Hashem, Uri, Kimekedem, Dorot Olamim, Halo Ati, Hamachzevet Rahav, Mecholele Tanin. So this is actually mythological. Weren't you, get up, wake up, O arm of God. weren't you the one who hacked Rahab into pieces, who pierced the dragon? Haloati amachrevet yam, mei tehom rabah, hasama mamake yam derech la'avor ge'ulim. And here he's pivoted from mythological to historical, right? Wasn't it you who split the sea and made the sea into dry land? A path for the ge'ulim, for the redeemed people to pass through. Now this is obviously not mythology, but Kriyat Yam Suf, right? The people who came out of Mitzrayim. So, Ufdei Hashem Yishuvu, Nuvau Tzion Birina, V'simchat Olam Arusham, Sosom V'simcha Yasigun, Nasu Yagon V'anacha. So too, let the people in Bavel come out with joy and rejoicing, and let them also rejoice. So again, calling on, we have a precedent for this. We went through this once already, let's do it again. Hashem, please get up and do it again. Alright, I won't read the Zechariah passage out loud, but he also, this is actually a very important passage for Esther, but we don't have to belabor it right now. So, if I say, fine, Jews in Bayit Sheni, Galut Bavel, Bayit Sheni, we're expecting a new Yitziat Mitzrayim, what does Esther have to say about Yitziat Mitzrayim? Right, so it sounds like nothing, right? And in a surface sense, it says nothing. Esther says absolutely nothing about Yitziat Mitzrayim. But there's a very, very explicit, but sort of only obliquely made point that's directly relevant to Yitziat Mitzrayim, which is the dates on which the story of Purim takes place. So what do we know about the dates? I put the Ki Psukim here on the bottom of the fourth page. In Paragimel, we hear that it was Chodesh HaRishon B'Shoshasar Yom Bo that Haman sent out his decrees, right? So Yud Gimel Nisan, Haman sent out his decrees. Then what happened? Well, next parak, Mordechai Adat Kol Asher Nasa, right? He goes to the palace. Same day, next day. There's no reason to think it should take more than a couple of hours. He has a copy of the decree. So what goes out? He has it. He goes to the palace. Let's just assume it doesn't really matter because we're talking about a day here or there. But let's just say Yud Gimel Nisan still, for argument's sake. He goes to Esther. He has a conversation with Esther. What does Esther say at the end of his long conversation? Fast for 3 days. So they start today, they start tomorrow, I don't know. Let's say they start tomorrow, today. Let's say they start today, just to keep it simple. So they start on Yud Gimel. They fast on Yud Gimel, Yud Dalet, Bayom HaShlishi, what happens? So it's also Pesach, it's also what happens in the Megillah on the third day. She goes to the king. Right? So in other words, she's going to the king, we could add a day if we feel like it, she's going to the king on Tetvav, or maybe Tetzayin, Nisan. Right, so notice the first banquet is either the first day of Sfirat HaOmer, second day of Sfirat HaOmer. It's right then, right? How did the Seder go that year? Well, interestingly, what were they doing at the Seder that year? Fasting. And Chazal actually pointed out. The Chazal, as you know, notice everything. They just say things in weird ways, so you have to sort of dig out what they mean from their comments. But they noticed that, a number of midrashim say Vayavor Mordechai at the end of Perek Dalet in Esther. Vayavor Mordechai Avar al Pesach. That he transgressed Pesach. He was fasting and therefore didn't observe Pesach. Okay, fine. But here's the key point. So, what does Esther actually say about Yitziat Mitzrayim? What are our hopes for Yitziat Mitzrayim here in Shushan? What do we do on Pesach? So, if Yechezkel and the Navi Yeshayahu and Zechariah were in Galut celebrating Pesach, this would be the highlight of their religious years because they say, this is it. This is typologically, this is the model for what we're going to experience, right? Let's read about what happened in Mitzrayim because this is what we're going to experience again. Now what does Esther say about Pesach? Hopefully, we'll survive another couple of days, right? Now they do survive another couple of days because, in a sense, because they didn't celebrate Pesach, right? By negating Pesach and fasting and preparing for what in fact is a very mundane way of saving the people, actually going and telling the king that we need to save the people. There's no Yad Chazakah here. There's no Zoro Netuyah here. There's no Makot. There's no Kriyat Yamsuf. There's some human negotiations that take place, coincidentally, on the same days that other people might have been anticipating a big Geulah. Chazal say, and we have reason to think other people would have said also, that Bayom Hazeh Nigalu, Bayom Hazeh Atidin Ligael, right? This is typological, this is it, this is the model. And Esther says, this is not the model for anything. This is the model for forget Pesach. It's not going to help you to live in the past. Stop dreaming about the future. Fast. Get together. We're going to the king. That's what's going to help us survive. Now, again, I think this is really very subversive. What's Geula in Megillat Esther? So we've already said, what's Geula here? Geula means we're saved. Meaning, where are we actually at the end of the Megillah? Almost exactly the same place we were at the beginning of the Megillah. Right? Geographically, that's literally true. Politically, right, we have more influence. Exactly. So good. So what does that mean? What are we going to use our influence for? So hopefully, if there's another Haman, we can beat him also. Now, Yitzhak Mitzrayim is amazing. What's Yitzhak Mitzrayim? Well, maybe I'll save this for next week because it's a little bit involved. But let me just mention, Yitzhak Mitzrayim, of course, was necessary because there was another Jew a long time ago who saved his people, helped his people by rising to power in a foreign court. Right, who is that? Yosef. Now, Yosef, it's great, right? It seems like a wonderful model. Right? You rise to power in a foreign court, you help your brothers, it's all great. The problem is, what happens when Yosef dies? That's right. Right? Next generation. Until they're avadim, and you needed Yitzhak Mitzrayim to come and swoop in and save you. Now, Mordechai and Esther, this we will talk about next week, I hope, Mordechai and Esther draw very heavily on the imagery of Yosef. All sorts of things that come to mind, the phrases. But again, the literary analysis is important for the political meaning. You're drawing on Yosef, that's great. But a reader might well say, okay, but we know how Yosef ends. Yosef's not the end of the story. What happens after Yosef? This is terrible, right? The Megillah focuses only on the Yosef part of the story. In other words, the Megillah leaves us entirely wondering, well, wait a second. That's great that Mordechai and Esther managed to save the Jews, but how long are Mordechai and Esther going to live? And Mishneh LeMelech doesn't seem to be a hereditary position, right? It's already gone from one person to another person. So it means the next generation, what's going to happen? Yeah, exactly. Right? Mordechai and Esther will die. These Jews will die. Presumably, Veko Melech Hadash al Parasuma die. Shelo Yadad Mordechai v'Esther. And who knows what's going to happen? Now, if you ask the author of the Megillah, I think the author of the Megillah has a very clear answer to this. The author of the Megillah says, that's not my problem. What do you mean it's not my problem? I mean, look, what can I do? I live in Shushan. What is my grand hope for living in Shushan? As a Jew in Shushan, what's my big aspiration for living here? Stay alive, gather some power, some influence, right? Let's make sure we have friends in high places. Let's make sure that the Jews in the empire are protected, are stable, that we don't have to worry about it existentially day to day. That we don't have to worry that tomorrow is going to be some other genocidal madman who's going to decide to kill all the Jews. No, our big goal is to establish someone like Esther or someone like Mordechai who can be at the right place at the right time and can step in and save the Jews. You tell me that's not good enough because maybe 50 years from now there'll be another problem? Look, we can't possibly work that way. No one can work that way, right? No politician, no one who works in the real world can possibly say, I can't do this now because it's not going to help me 50 years from now. What I need to do first and foremost is make sure that life now is good and that I have checks there and I have protections there and that I've done what I can for this generation. I can hope that this generation will serve as a model, that people will see, that life will get better and so on. I can hope that there won't be another Haman. Of course I can hope that. I could hope that history will go differently and there won't be genocidal pharaohs again. But there's nothing I can do about that. I can't prevent that preemptively from where I sit right now. What is Geula? From a Galut perspective, sitting in Paras HaMadai, and this is not said cynically, I don't think it's a satire, but it's also not said proudly. It's simply said realistically. What is Geula here? Geula is, this generation is now safe. Right? We have beaten Haman, Esther is the queen, Mordechai is the Mishneh LeMelech, there's taxes, life is stable, life is fine. What's going to happen next? I don't really have any idea what's going to happen next. How can I possibly know what's going to happen next? I've done my job for this generation, though, in establishing that the Jews here and now, and for the next 10, 20, 30 years, are in a good situation. Now, let me just add one thing. Here, who might have responded relatively quickly? I don't know how to formulate this exactly, because it depends on a lot of questions that we just don't know the answers to. But if we line up Tanakh historically, right, if we read Tanakh as one grand story, which of course Jews have long done, then who comes after Achashverosh? What's the next story? The next story, after Achashverosh, after Xerxes, comes to some Artaxerxes. Who's Artaxerxes? Artaxasta in Tanakh. And in the seventh year of Artaxasta is Ezra. Exactly. And pretty quickly thereafter is Nehemiah. Now, where does Nehemiah live? I'll just fix that on Nehemiah for a second. Where does Nehemiah live? In Shushan. And the king says to him, hey, Nehemiah, you don't look so happy. What can I do for you? And unlike Esther, who says, please save my people, here and now, I want to live, right? I would even accept slavery. I would even accept slavery. I just won't accept genocide, says Esther, right? An incredible statement. Okay, I mean, that's really giving up a tremendous amount. Right? I wouldn't argue if the Jews were slaves in diaspora. I'm only arguing because we're going to be killed. Unlike that very beaten down, very subservient attitude that Esther brings to the king, Nehemiah says, you know, you want to help me? You know what I want to do? I want to go to Yerushalayim. And you know what I want to do there? I want to build the walls, and I want to establish some sort of political autonomy and independence there. So where does the reaction come? So it's not only here that there's the reaction to Esther. If the author, I don't think that's what the author of Esther thinks. The author of Esther says, look, we've succeeded, we're in power, we're good for now. But the rest of Tanakh says, that's not enough. That's not enough. You know what the next book you should read is? Now read Ezra and Nehemiah. Because if you think that that's enough to just live through the days of Achashverosh and live happily ever after in Galut, intermarried, because hey, the Jews are safe now, you're not going to get some of the big themes of Tanakh. Ezra and Nehemiah, let's go back. 1 second, because I promised someone else. Sorry.
Oh,
sorry.
But now I have a better perspective of why Chazal were in the Gemara are not very happy with Esther and Mordechai. They say, don't say Hallel, because you're still slaves
Right. And if you remember who says that, there's three opinions as to why we don't say Hallel. Rava, where does Rava live?
In Bavel.
Rava, sitting in Bavel, says, why say Hallel and Purim? Akate avdei d'Achashverosh anan, right? We're still in Bavel. What's Hallel? Hallel is for Pesach.
Therefore, don't say it on Purim because it doesn't
fill the story. In other words, Rava, he says, look, Esther's great, right? Kol hakavod lahem that they survived. I'm not going to say Hallel. That's mugzam, right? You survive. That's a major... If you don't survive, it's terrible. But to survive is not exactly worthy of Hallel. Let me end with one point. I said Chazal saw everything, which is also mugzam, but let me just end with one thing. You have at the top of the second page... a passage that we find both in the Bavli and in the Yerushalmi in slightly different versions, but which sounds a little bit sort of trite or cute at first, and then I think you realize that they're actually doing something incredibly deep to Esther in what they're doing. So this is what we have. Chazal tell the story, this little story, that Esther wanted to be in Tanakh. She wanted to be in Tanakh. So Shalcha lehem Esther lechachamim, k'tavuni ledorot, write me down forever. Right? Meaning, where do Jews write things down forever? In Tanakh. Put me into Tanakh. Things are not in Tanakh. They'll be forgotten. So they wrote back. Shachula, halo katavti lecha shalishim. It's a weird word in Mishlei. Shalishim velo ribeim. So they wrote back, we can't. It says in Mishlei, in a totally unrelated pasuk, I wrote for you triples. Triples, not quadruples. What are we talking about? 1 second. Ad shemasulo mikra katuv b'Torah, until they found a pasuk that licenses Esther in the Torah. K'tov zot zikaron b'sefer. I don't remember where that's from.
Amalek.
The first Amalek in Shemot Yud Zayin. And then Parashat B'Shalach. And they explain, K'tov zot, ma shekatuv kanu b'mishneh Torah. K'tov zot is reference to the first two stories of Amalek. In Shemot, and then again, Timchet Zechar Amalek, Parashat Zachor, in Dvarim. Zikaron is a reference to Masha Ketuv Ba'Neviim, the story of Amalek in Neviim. Where's the story of Amalek in Neviim? Shaul, exactly. And Basefer Mashakatu Bamigila, and what's in the book is what's written in the, okay, so this is a really bizarre midrashic reading, right? They take this pasuk, which they had forgotten about, and they say, oh wait, we have a pasuk, it's okay now. We have the pasuk, we broke it up into different things, so one refers to Shmuel and Zvarim, one refers to Shaul, one refers to you, you're good, you can come into Tanakh. What's going on here? But what are Chazal actually doing here? So what they're really doing is exactly what you said. They're saying, first of all, Esther, you want to be in Tanakh? Malach v'la Tanakh. Right? Tanakh tells a grand story. Right? And it's true. And this is a very important point that sometimes we lose track of because we read, you know, a Perek or even a Sefer, but we don't read all of Tanakh. If we read the narratives of Tanakh, Tanakh tells a grand story. How Bnei Israel got Eretz Israel, how they lost the land, and then how they got it again. Right? That's the story of Tanakh. Okay, so it's told in slightly more detail, but that's the story of Tanakh. But Esther has nothing to do with that story, right? Esther is a sort of parenthesis, like, oh, and while they were there, they were almost killed, but they weren't. Back to the real story. So first of all, Chazal say, Esther, you want to be in Tanakh, but you don't fit into Tanakh. You have nothing to do with Tanakh, right? Tanakh tells a story. You don't have nothing to do with Beit David, you have nothing to do with the Beit HaMikdash, you have nothing to do with Hashem, no Nevi'im, no Yerushalayim, no Eretz Israel. Where do you fit into Tanakh? You have nothing to do with the rest of Tanakh. Right? Until they said, oh, this is where it's finding. Where do they find it? What's the link? Amalek. But it's better than that. So first of all, it's just amazing that they say, you can be in Tanakh if we find a pasuk in Tanakh that licenses you. Right? And as if Tanakh itself talks about you, then you must be in Tanakh. So this is already, like, incredibly an intricate way of thinking about Tanakh. But second of all, you are part of the grand story. Right? You're part of the grand story of, what's the story? Story of Kibush Haaretz. How are you story of Kibush Haaretz? Okay, one second. But even more than that, it's even part of Kibush Haaretz. Because, as we said, wiping out Amalek is part of Kibush Haaretz, right? When you get peace in the land, then Tibchetzeh Amalek. So, they didn't do it then. Now we have a problem. How can we wipe out Amalek? Where's Amalek now in the Persian Empire? They're all over the place. They're enemies of the Jews all over the place. So if we're going to wipe out Amalek, which is a mitzvah that's never been fulfilled, where do the Jews have to be? All over the Persian Empire, right? And it's the only way to fulfill the mitzvah in the Torah of Timchet Zeich Amalek is for the Jews to be scattered across the empire in order to track down all of the enemies of the Jews. But what's the logical follow-up then? What should happen after they do that? They should come back. Now, it's not an accident that according to Chazal, this is historically not true, but according to Chazal, Esther did have a son. Who's her son? Dayavish. Dayavish. Under whose reign, what happened? They built the Beit HaMikdash. In other words, what if Chazal succeeded in doing? Succeeded in putting Esther right into the grand story of Jewish history, of Tanakh. Esther's not just a sort of footnote that something happened once in Persia. On the contrary, in order to get to the second part of the story, the end of the story, the Geula with the Beit HaMikdash, Bayit Sheni, under Ezra and Nehemiah, and so on, in order to do that, the Jews had to take a temporary hiatus from the sort of straightforward narrative. They had to go to Paras, they had to go to Madai, they had to go to Behodu Be'al Kush, track down their enemies there, Mechiyat Amalek once and for all, because that was a mitzvah that had not been fulfilled when it was supposed to have been, fix what Shaul failed to do, and now that license is the end of the story, which is now we can go back to Yerushalayim, now we can build the Beit HaMikdash, and so on and so forth. Now Chazal's history is not our history, let's put it that way, but the way Chazal read the story is incredibly sophisticated. What they're doing is grappling with exactly the question of, Esther doesn't fit into anything else about Tanakh that I know of, ad shematzu mikra katuv batorah, until we can figure out how the Torah itself incorporates Esther into the grand story. Once they can do that, then of course Esther has a place in Tanakh, right in between Daniel, which talks about Galut Bavel, and Ezra Nehemiah, which talks about the middle of the Persian Empire, right in between there. You need to know about Esther, because that explains how we get from here to there. Now again, that's Chazal's correction, right? And that's what I said at the beginning. By seeing what they correct, you also see what bothers them. So by the fact that they say, how can I put you in Tanakh until I find the pasuk that licenses it, what it means is they said, There's nothing about Esther that relates to the rest of Tanakh. Esther is against all of the important themes of Tanakh until they can figure out how to solve that problem and actually incorporate Esther into the grand story. All right, so that's all I have time for this evening. I guess next week what I hope to do is to talk about the characters of Mordechai and Esther, Yosef, and some other versions of Esther that floated around during Bayit Sheni that corrected Esther. But let's just end with a couple last comments and questions, and then we'll break for now.
There are other places where a holiday is put off because of circumstances, and I don't think it's such an earth-shattering event, but I may be wrong. I'm thinking of Hanukkah, where Sukkot wasn't celebrated. In time, and it would simply move. So I'm not sure
about the Pesach thing.
Right? Off this, when with the threat of extermination over their heads, is such a major.
Well, first of all, to be clear, I didn't mean to criticize them.
No, okay.
Right. I mean, it's clear. Like, of course, they had to do that. That's actually there's one midrash. I don't remember where, but one midrash actually says that that Mordechai hesitated and said, "How can we fast for the next 3 days? Seder's coming up. We've all cooked already." And Esther says, I don't know exactly what Lashon, but it essentially says, I think she actually says, Manhig Bayudimata, or something like that. If we don't do this now, we won't have any more Pesach to celebrate. So of course you have to do it. So I didn't mean to say that it was great. Of course you have to do it, but it's very realistic. It's very, you know, instead of saying like Pesach, this is the most important day because this is the typological model. No, okay, but pragmatic.
Putting it off because they don't feel like it, or they don't agree with the Pesach model.
But there's no answer.
Right. There's no suggestion. Right. They simply can't do it.
And of course, and every other year, of course, they celebrated Pesach. I don't mean that they were opposed to Pesach, but I mean that the story actually does mention Pesach, but mentions it obliquely in a way to essentially nullify it in the context of this story. All right. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. She hasn't even asked her question yet. Don't clap. Wait, yeah. Sir, 1 second. Sorry.
What you said now about Hazar is the connection to Confessor Carmelech explains the tedious narration of the end about how they killed this and they killed that, and the whole accent on the killing and the killing and the killing, which, like you said in the beginning, it's sort of tedious that it doesn't feel like it fits the beginning. But if this is part of that they had actually seek out Amalek and kill all of them.
Interesting. That's interesting. That's a very good point. Good point. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I thought you were done already.
No, I didn't know someone was still going.
No, an excellent point that the Amalek connection puts the massacring of the enemies and the extra day and the fixation on the counting in a different light. If Bnei Israel have to kill all these people because this is Amalek incarnate and that's the whole point, then it's very important to say they killed them and they got every single last one and there were some left and we asked for another day. That the killing turns out not to just be defensive, as in the Megillah it seems to be, but actually seems to be cosmically significant because you're rectifying the failure to wipe out Amalek that was supposed to have happened a long time ago.
Maybe it's also a message for us now.
Probably not.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.